In the world of literary journalism, no writer is more esteemed or more influential than Rebecca Solnit. Her range is galactic. Her incessant curiosity drives her to explore everything from nuclear testing to photography, to the precarious and often dangerous relationships of men to women. She has written about atlases, Alzheimer's disease, the history of walking, climate change, the desert, fairy tales, the color blue, punk music, and of course, contemporary politics. She is fascinated by landscapes, our ties to the natural world, and the existential conflicts embedded in maps and stories. Her writing about what it means to move through the world in a female body is incendiary and essential. It has given her readers a whole new vocabulary for talking about their experiences and the blueprints for a better society. She also has an enduring fascination with what happens to communities in times of crisis and what disasters reveal about human nature. That was the subject of her 2009 book, A Paradise Built in Hell. Rebecca Solnit was born in Connecticut in 1961. She grew up in Novato, California. She has lived most of her life in San Francisco, a city that is integral to her writing and her personal geography. In her new memoir, Recollections of My Non-Existence, she writes about how San Francisco and the American West shaped her as a person, how she came to understand the epidemic of violence against women, and how she developed her voice in a world that wants to keep women silent. I talked to her in February before the COVID-19 pandemic spread around the globe and radically altered our lives here in Canada, before we all got a chance to see firsthand what happens to communities in extraordinary and unsettling times. Rebecca Solnit joined me from KQED in San Francisco. Ms. Solnit, good morning. Welcome back to the program.
Lovely to be there, even virtually. Hello, Canada.
Thank you.
I never get to say hello to a country like that.
Yeah, well, you do it every time you're on, and we appreciate it. Well, believe me. We say hello.
Thank you.
We say hello
thank
back.
Thank you. I'm waving north.
I want to ask you a question about the title. It's very despairing to think of you as non-existing. Where does that come from, my non-existence, Recollections?
I've had books where I struggled for the titles and books where the title was the first thing and is kind of a catalyst. This title came up early as I was thinking about this project. It describes many things, and not all non-existence is terrible. Some of it is, including the feeling I had as a young woman that it was really likely I might be raped, and in the course of being raped, I might be murdered, and that the whole culture didn't want to talk about the real violence all around us, but made it kind of fun and sexy and celebratory in movies and music and pop culture generally, with all its fun rape jokes and cartoons and things like that. Yeah. And it was also about the fact that how do you evade men who are menacing you? You, because you don't have a voice, because you can't say stop, because that sometimes makes them worse or does nothing. You learn to disappear, evade, fade away, slip out, sort of extract yourself. And so you're constantly disappearing in order to survive. Mm. And so that's one of the forms. But it's also about the wonderful disappearance into books, in which I spent so much of my life, particularly when I was young, just devouring a whole novel a day sometimes. And that state as a reader in which you're everything and nothing in the book. Nobody sees you, but you see everything through the narrative. And then also, it's a book about the other forms of non-existence I encountered as I got involved in Native American land rights. Mm-hmm. As I got close to a lot of gay men who had their own threats, including homophobia and AIDS and closetedness to deal with, as I watched a black neighborhood that I lived in disappear through gentrification, So I think we all have some non-existence in our lives. And how and where we appear and to whom is a huge question. And what prevents us from appearing or punishes us for showing up?
What is scattered throughout the memoir is the indication that we're living in a time when the issues that you've been writing about for decades now are all coming to a head, it seems to me. The environment, gender politics, again, violence toward women, indigenous rights, disasters. How do you think we're reckoning with all of this? How are we dealing with the moment?
I think that my whole life, which is pretty long by now, has been lived amidst innumerable revolutions, which are not the sudden eruption in which a regime topples, but transformations of how we think about gender, how we think about nature, how we think about race, how we think about family, how we think about human rights. And a lot of it has been democratizing in the broadest possible way to distribute more widely power and voice and representation and recognition and agency, not only among human beings, but also to acknowledge the rights of nature and non-human beings and the earth itself in some ways. And I think if you see that, and if you see the deep values underneath it of egalitarianism, of deep listening, of inclusion, it's pretty exciting. And of course, there's a huge backlash against it. I could mention my president and Bolsonaro and Brazil and Putin and all sorts of other sort of white supremacist, misogynist, homophobic destroyers of nature who in their nastiness also prove that it's all connected. And because the ideology against all these things connects them as well.
But you, at the same time this is happening, you write that we are living in a series of interiors disconnected from one another. So at the same time we have this kind of globalist community, yet we are in our little interior world.
I'm not sure what you mean by that. Do you mean that we're in our we all live inside our own stories and
worldviews? I think you were getting at that. Yeah, disconnected from one another.
It's interesting in the ways in which all that is changing. And one of the things I write about in this book is just what the texture of everyday life was like as a city person, when payphones were a big important part of the landscape, before cell phones, before the internet, when we spent a lot more time coping calmly with uncertainty and unpredictability about whether the bus would arrive or we'd wave down a taxi or we'd walk or whether our friend was home or whether we needed to rearrange something. And so there's those kinds of things that have changed a lot. And we're disconnected, I think, in ways we used to be connected, and connected in ways that were unimaginable when I was young. And so there's been, I think, a great rearrangement and a reconstitution of what it means to be human in the digital world, some of which is really destructive and a lot of which emanates from a place I used to be really proud to come from, the San Francisco Bay Area, which I used to think of as the land of Harvey Milk and the Sierra Club.
Right.
And now I think of as the land of Uber and Twitter and Airbnb and Google and Facebook, which are much more malevolent forces overall.
I'm curious to know how you got started writing. I know that you were always involved with words and books and so on, but what was the genesis? Was there one particular spark that got you into writing?
Learning how to read, basically.
Uh-huh.
I loved stories before I could read and was just besotted with stories, and didn't quite understand that books were these magic boxes if you knew how to open them, which is what literacy is. There were, whole libraries full of boxes you could open that had whole other worlds and people, magical beings and possibility, knowledge and power, and transformation and transmutation inside them. So, the year I learned how to read, I decided I wanted to be a writer. And of course, deciding to be a writer is easy as deciding to have a cup of coffee. Becoming a writer is a slightly more tricky proposition.
Did you have illustrated classic comics when you were growing up?
No, I didn't, but I am a girl from a family of boys, and so I read so much boys' stuff growing up. My brothers read sci-fi and lots of books with boy protagonists, some sports books, and they had tons of Mad magazines and comics, and unfortunately later, towering mountains of Playboys bought at rummage sales, and I may be the only person who actually looked at the magazine for the, you know, the printed word. And it's actually kind of gross to think of a little girl who's just run through everything else in the house, reading the Playboy philosophy and all this creepy stuff that helped teach me to look at women as commodities and see the world from a man's point of view. It was there.
How do you find your ideas? You say that ideas are the protagonists of essays. And there's a lovely phrase in the book, or in one of your books anyway, that says that the musing takes place in a kind of meadowland of imagination. I love that phrase. Where do the ideas come from?
A lot of what I feel like I do is find patterns, and often it feels not like I've seen one thing that's significant, but I've seen the last of the pieces that suddenly click into a pattern. But I wander around like a beachcomber, picking up this and that and thinking it's interesting. And then suddenly one more piece comes along and I see a pattern and it all fits together. And one of the joys of writing is it pushes me, because I feel like I'm a lazy person most of the time, to think harder and go deeper and figure out how these things are working and what they have in common.
For decades, Rebecca Solnit has written her essays on the same desk, one with an extraordinary backstory. Here is Rebecca Solnit reading a passage from Recollections of My Non-Existence.
A friend gave me a desk not long after I moved into the apartment, a woman's small writing desk or vanity, the one I am writing on now. It's a dainty Victorian piece of furniture with four narrow drawers, two on each side, and a broader central drawer above the bay in which the sitter's legs go, and various kinds of ornamentation. Dowled legs, each with a knob like a knee, knobby ornaments, scallops on the bottom of the drawers, drawer pulls like tassels or teardrops. There are two pairs of legs on the front, two on the back, set beneath the side drawers. Despite all the frills, the old desk is fundamentally sturdy, an eight-legged beast of burden whose back has carried many things over the decades, or two beasts of burden side by side, yoked together by the desktop. The desk has moved with me three times. It's the surface on which I've written millions of words, more than 20 books, reviews, essays, love letters, several thousand emails to my friend Tina during the years of our near-daily epistolatory exchange, a few hundred thousand other emails, some eulogies and obituaries, including those of both of my parents, a desk at which I did the homework of a student and then a teacher, a portal onto the world, and my platform for reaching out and diving inward. A year or two before she gave me the desk, my friend was stabbed 15 times by an ex-boyfriend to punish her for leaving him. She almost bled to death. She had emergency transfusions. She was left with long scars all over her body, which I saw then without response, because whatever capacity to feel had been muffled, maybe when I got habituated to violence at home, maybe because it was something we were supposed to take in stride and be nonchalant about, back when few of us had language to talk about such violence or an audience ready to listen. She survived. She was blamed for what happened, as victims often were then and still often are now. There were no legal consequences for the would-be murderer. She moved far from what happened. She worked for a single mother who was evicted and who gave her the desk in lieu of wages, and then she gave it to me when I was 19. She moved on and we lost touch for many years and then reestablished it, and she told me the full story, a story that could make your heart catch fire and the world freeze over. Someone tried to silence her. Then she gave me a platform for my voice. Now I wonder if everything I've ever written is a counterweight to that attempt to reduce a young woman to nothing.
It's the contrast of the delicacy of the desk and the gift with the horror of the assault. It's quite dislocating.
Good.
Yeah, it's supposed to be. That shaped your... How did that experience shape your writing? How did it... You say it gave you a platform, but...
The desk has just been my desk since I was 19, so yeah. That's 39 years. And that's really the beginning of when I started to write things beyond class assignments and letters. So literally everything I've written has been written at least in part on, you know, every book has... A lot of what I've written, every book has been written at least in part on that desk. And it's one of the joys of writing. I knew exactly what happened to her, and I knew that I'd written everything on that desk that's been my desk all of my adult life. But I never thought about what does it mean that everything I've ever written was written on a gift from a woman a man tried to silence so brutally. And it's interesting because what I really said there, I don't know how it registered with you, is I don't feel like I was impacted a lot because I was so numbed to the norm of violence against women. And that's a lot what this book is about. We have had a lot of memoirs, and they're good and important, and I've read many of them, in which one terrible thing happens directly to a woman. She's the person who's assaulted. She's the person who has an abusive spouse. She's the person who's raped. She's the person a man tries to murder. A lot of what I'm trying to do in this book is to say, we're not just affected by the things that happen directly to us. A friend of mine said to me recently, as a young woman, you spend your whole life being instructed on how not to get murdered. You know, don't wear this, don't drink that, don't hang out with them, don't travel alone, don't hitchhike, don't go camping, don't go hiking, don't. And we never say, you should live in a world in which you can do anything you want. We need to change the world so that women are as free as men. We're just told male violence is inevitable as the weather, and you should just prepare yourself to cope with that weather. And it impacts me that my mother was a battered woman. It impacts me that my friend was almost stabbed to death. It impacts me that a lot of my friends were raped. Some were stalked. Some were beaten. It impacts me that I know a man whose mother was murdered by her second husband. It impacts me... Because we are not separate, that this happens to people all around me because they're women. It impacts me that we live in a world in which a lot of men want to harm women, and we have yet to have an adequate conversation about it. We have yet to do enough to stop it.
What did you mean when you wrote, mm-hmm. we die all the time to avoid being killed?
If you don't speak up because you're afraid of what the consequences will be. If you don't report you were raped because you know rapists so rarely are convicted and that you're the one who'll be put on trial for how it was your fault and what is your sexual history. If you don't, you know, resist because you know resistance won't get you anywhere. You die in so many ways when you feel that you can't speak, that your voice has no power. And it goes right down to why women don't necessarily resist and say no in the textbook ways we're always told we're supposed to, which is all about a fantasy that we all have equal power and that when I say no,
it'll stop
someone.
Everything will stop, yeah.
And there's a woman who testified in the Weinstein trial that saying no seemed to excite him. It certainly wasn't going to make him stop. So... And that's a situation in which you have no voice. So should you even say anything?
Shortly after the conviction of Harvey Weinstein in New York, you wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times. You said in the piece, it was a warning, the Weinstein trial and subsequent conviction, that the age of impunity is over. There are people willing to listen to women. But does it disturb you that he was acquitted on 3 of the 5 counts? Does that not mean those women weren't believed?
I felt with a jury that I believe was majority white men, the fact he was convicted with what another person writing in the New York Times recognized as the kind of messy stories that are what we mostly have.
Right.
Women who continued to maintain contact with him, women who were not the pure perfect victim who, you know, went to police 20 minutes after it was all over and et cetera. I think the fact he was convicted, given the resources at his disposal, given the social prejudices against women and in favor of powerful men, given that he had impunity for 40 years, I think any conviction is a victory. And I called it a warning because the reason why it matters is not because one man's getting punished, because a whole lot of other powerful men are going to see that and say, maybe I'm not going to get away with this. Maybe people are actually going to listen to women some of the time. But that's not good enough either. I don't want a world where this doesn't happen as much because men are afraid there will be consequences, although the ones who have the urges should be. I want to live in a world where it doesn't occur to a man that he has a right and a desire to do horrible things to women. You know, as a storyteller, I feel like there are stories that are prisons that trap us and leave right people out of the history and prevent them from speaking up. And there are other stories that liberate and free us and invite us in. And we are living in a revolution in storytelling, and that's partly about, as the title of my previous book goes, whose story is this? We are changing who gets to tell the story, and that freaks out some people who are the main storytellers, who think if they don't have 100% of the pie, they get zero, you know, and changing who the story is centered on is such a radical thing and such a great experiment happening in so many ways.
Yeah. My guest this morning is Rebecca Solnit, the essayist, writer, author of many books. Her latest is called Recollections of My Non-Existence. It's a memoir, but it's also a teaching tool, I think, about the relationship between men and women and the violence that springs up all too often between them. She's in San Francisco this morning. So much of your work has been about landscapes, urban, rural. Here, you wrote a wonderful book of particular interest to me about Ireland. What has sparked your fascination with place? You said that places matter, that they map our lives.
When I said I was a little kid besotted with stories, I was really besotted with two things. I was besotted with places and nature, a kind of child geography, geophilia, and with stories. I was a weird, introverted kid who didn't fit in well with my peers, a girl in a family of boys, a kid without many friends until well into my 20s, etc. And I feel like places befriended me, places supported me, places loved me. We talk about love of place. I think there's a way places love you back, and there's no goofy way to say they're always there. But I have been visiting some of the same hills, some of the same trees for almost my entire life. There's a kind of reassurance and familiarity you get. There's also inspiration, sublimity, vastness.
What is it about deserts?
Well, deserts are one of the places I came to love later. And I think a lot of us did as we found stories and representations that got us past how Europeans who liked all that lush, green, grassy stuff, that busy, damp stuff, began to understand this stark, sublime beauty of the dry places, which are harsh and sometimes dangerous. But also what I got from place is a sense of liberation. If you can see 50 miles, if there's no impediments between you and the mountain range, 20 miles in the clear distance, if you can roam all day, you know, and walking was part of it, space in which to move, space in which to be free, which is also what Recollections of My Non-Existence is about, that I wanted to just be free to walk in cities and in the country, and the fact that women were constantly being menaced, and I was being menaced, you know, even on a hiking trail, it's like, okay, men are approaching me, I'm going to be on my guard, because then I was hiking as a young woman where the trailside killer was, who was killing women hikers, and this stuff is really normal. So that's, you know, so spaces were my friends, my allies, my support, my literal foundation, the ground I stood on, my solace, my refuge. But the ability to move freely through them was impeded because I was a woman. And I quote Sylvia Plath in there again, because I quoted her in my book on walking. She wants to talk to everyone. She wants to sleep under the stars. She wants to roam freely. But because she's a woman, she can't do any of these things. She writes this when she's 19, and it's so heartbreaking. And you can't read that without thinking, if Sylvia Plath had all that freedom, would she have locked herself up in her kitchen and turned the gas on after her husband abandoned her? Would that domestic tragedy and that incredibly domestic way of killing herself have happened had she not been so confined to the domestic sphere by how women are defined, by how her life was contained within those definitions and limits?
Tell me what you're interested in, and I won't call it an obsession, but you've certainly written about it, the Nevada A-bomb, H-bomb test site. Why is that crucial to you?
Well, it was such a remarkable place. It's partly how I learned how to love the desert, because my first few trips to the desert, I kind of didn't know how to explore it, how to be in that kind of space, what kind of beauties to look for beyond the conventional beauty that we've all been trained to admire in lusher landscapes. But also it was this great peace movement against nuclear weapons that brought an extraordinary collection of people from Mormon downwinders to nuclear physicists to Japanese atomic survivors to atomic veterans to eco-feminists and anarchists all together. And the test site was just such an extraordinary experience of this sublime vastness of the place, of the quite intense possibility of an all-out world-annihilating nuclear war than in the 1980s that still seemed real, of the resurgence of this extraordinary Native American presence that I would join up with as the Western Shoshone land rights movement. There was so much going on in that one place, so many meanings. It taught me first that a place is a point of intersection of many forces coming from many distances. The Western Shoshone were in Nevada, but the history of the atom bomb is in Europe and Los Alamos and other parts of the Manhattan Project and the Cold War between the U.S. and the USSR. And, you know, and I realized that as a writer, I needed to use everything I'd learned, because when I was a young woman going to the test site, I was writing in three different ways. I was writing in the pseudo-objectivity of journalism and its objective, you know, no first-person voice. I was writing criticism and essays about art and in a kind of authoritative first-person voice, which, like, these are my views, but you know, they have a certain weight to them. And then I was writing much more lyrical, personal, subjective stuff where I brought my own interior life into it. And the test site taught me that I needed all those voices and made me realize they didn't need to be separate. You could narrate a history. You could describe political reality. You could use the tools I learned as an art critic to analyze a nuclear weapon, the misrepresentation or erasure of Native people, with the same tools you use to analyze a work of art. And you had to use that first-person voice to describe what does it actually feel like to watch a glorious sunset while handcuffed in a cattle pen full of other handcuffed people who share your beliefs. What is it like to drive towards the violence being wrought against Native American matriarchs defending their rights? What is it like to realize that everything you've been told about the history of the West is a lie because of how it erased Native people, and that the environmental movement wasn't part of the good guys there. It was part of the erasure. And so I brought all these voices together. And so I say the Nevada test site taught me to write. It brought me into this extraordinary community. And it taught me to love the desert. And people often think of activism as some sort of virtue signaling, and it's like flossing and eating your broccoli. But sometimes it can be the most delicious and wonderful and inspiring thing that can possibly happen to you. You know, it really shaped me in a lot of ways.
Something else that shaped you is an ongoing interest in what happens to cities, communities, after a major disaster? What happens to the people? Why the interest in that? What does it tell us about human nature?
Well, in 1906, San Francisco had a massive earthquake.
Yep.
And what happened in that is that the U.S. military and the city government and the state militia all freaked out, decided that ordinary people were the enemy and protecting private property was the highest goal, and started shooting looters on site. They may have, and became a destructive force that burned down a lot of the city that was not destroyed by the earthquake, shot a lot of people, terrorized the populace, and prevented them from fighting fire. We live inside stories, and they had a story about human nature that said that ordinary people are basically savage, and only the threat of institutional authority with its capacity for violence makes us all behave well, and when that falls apart in a disaster. And that's actually a lie. And so then I saw those lies in Hurricane Katrina justify a militarized and violent response that treated survivors of the disaster still in the city as criminals and monsters, rapists and pillagers and violent people who needed to be subjugated, needed to be locked down in a ruined city with no resources, no medical care, and treated them essentially as a hostile enemy. And a lot of people died because of that story. And I had learned by reading the oral histories of those six earthquakes and by reading the wonderful disaster sociologists in a field that begins in part with Samuel Prince looking at the Halifax explosion in 1917 mm-hmm. to get all Canadian on you. But I had gotten this incredible information from the oral histories and the sociologists that actually in disasters, most people are altruistic, brave, communitarian, generous, and deeply creative in rescuing each other, creating the conditions of survival, and often creating these little disaster utopias where everyone feels equal, everyone feels like a participant. And so there's two really important things there, one of which is that people are actually in this sort of this sudden, it's like a reset when you turn a machine on and off and on again, that our basic default setting is generous and communitarian and altruistic. But what's also exciting for me about that, and that was shocking, is the incredible joy people often seem to have when they describe that sense of purpose, connection, community, agency they found. And it speaks to how deeply we desire something we mostly don't have in everyday life. That's a kind of social public love mm-hmm. and power above and beyond the private life we're all told to seek all our satisfactions in.
Was that the case in New Orleans when those thousands of people were forced into the Coliseum? And
Superdome.
The Superdome. The cops blockaded any way to get out. It didn't seem to me like a communitarian exercise.
It was. People were trapped in a lot of places, and young men who were being portrayed as gangbangers and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, were taking care of women with small children and stuff like that. People were taking care of each other. I've talked with this. I read the histories of 06. I've read the oral histories of the Halifax explosion, the London Blitz, the Mexico City earthquake, etc. But I have heard a lot of these stories firsthand yeah. of New Orleans. People were beautifully taking care of each other inside the catastrophe. And a lot of what was being portrayed as looting was people in the absence of electricity, of the existence of commerce, getting necessary supplies for each other. And it was so misunderstood. Some fancy newscaster making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year shamed a small black boy on national TV who was taking a pink t-shirt inside a Walmart that the cops were looting, and by sneering at him like, "I don't think that's your color." And
if you know what
actually happens in disasters, that kid is a hero. That kid's mom or sister or auntie or friend might have swum through toxic water or sewage or something, and he's getting her a clean yeah. shirt, and he's a good kid. So that happened not just in the week or two that New Orleans was turned into a prison city, people weren't allowed to evacuate from. But inside the city, people did beautiful things. And of course, a disaster never ends. And a lot of extraordinary community effort and what might be the biggest international volunteer effort in American history happened to rebuild, to help resituate people, to do ecological restoration, to rethink the city, to, you know, and it doesn't mean, but what also happened was that elite panic. And so both things were happening at once. The cops were shooting black people in the back. White vigilantes were also shooting black people. And I grew close to one, Donnell Harrington, who was a great hero and a great rescuer before a vigilante shot him in the back just for being a black man and a white neighborhood, and he almost died, like my friend with the desk, almost bled to death.
You talk about the way crises can liberate us from the disaster, quote, the disaster of everyday life. And I was thinking of the Chekhov quote, where he said that any idiot can face a crisis. It's the day-to-day living that wears you down.
Well, in day-to-day living, we face structures that are built up to isolate and alienate us. People who find their deepest meaning and satisfaction in their connection to each other don't make good consumers. People who know how powerful we are when we gather together are good at telling their governments what to do and not to obey. You know, so we have a lot of forces that want to tell us that we are privatized people, we want sex and a bunch of nice stuff, we have no connection to the people around us, our differences separate us, don't even bother trying. And yet that reset shows us how much we desire membership in a community, a sense of belonging, a sense of agency, a sense of power that isn't what we get told about and who we are.
Okay, I don't want in the few moments we have left, I don't want to destroy that image that you've created, but when you look around the United States, talking about hope, when you look around the United States these days, with the terrible things going on at the southern border, with the current occupant of the White House, the anger, the polarization, that where you no longer oppose your enemy, you hate your enemy. Where do you get hope in the current United States of America?
I think that you can see a lot of what's happening as a backlash. These are people who, as my kindergarten teacher would have said, are not good at sharing. Are reacting against a world in which we, the countries that helped cause so much climate change, need to take in people who are so often climate refugees and refugees from other things we have a hand in. They don't want to share with people of color. They don't want to share with queer and trans people. They don't want to share with women, which kind of narrows down who they are. And, they're angry and frightened because they have a zero-sum story where there isn't enough for everybody. And that scarcity economics that drives miserable behavior from personal family life to public life drives them. But that's not all that's happening. We had extraordinary elections the last 3 years in this country where we elected the first Native woman to Congress, the first Latina senator, et cetera. We had these blue waves. And this is a backlash because it's trying to hold back the future. Michelle Alexander, one of the great voices in the country right now, the woman who wrote The New Jim Crow, wrote a piece last year that had such a huge impact on me where she said, "We are not the resistance. They are the resistance. We are the river they are trying to dam, but the dam cannot hold. In 2045, this country will be a non-white majority country. The future that's coming is in so many ways everything we could dream of if they don't destroy it all first." And I often feel that middle-aged people like me just have to try and hold back that destruction before younger people who are more inherently intersectionally non-sexist, non-racist, who more inherently grasp all this, take charge. And, so I have hope.
But what if all that What if all that is erased if in the November election the current occupant of the White House is reelected?
Well, it won't erase everything. I live in California, which is the seventh biggest economy in the world, and regularly defies the Trump administration and sets laws from emission standards to protecting refugees that are influential for the rest of the country. States and localities in the Bush era did a lot to set their own policy and still do. But also, you know, the United States is not the world. 4 years is not forever. I sure hope he isn't reelected. We don't know what's going to happen. My hope is not optimism. Optimism is everything will be fine no matter what, and sit back in confidence. Just like pessimism, which is everything's going to suck no matter what. And it equally says just sit back and do nothing. Hope for me means we don't know what's going to happen, and that's a reason to try and shape what happens. It's why I went around last year saying don't ask what's going to happen. Be what happens, particularly to the amazing young climate activists changing the world for us all right now. You know, you can't be hopeless because not everything is perfect. If that's your criterion, you can just, you know, go bury yourself right now.
Hide under the bed. You would go with Dr. King at the Arc of History, bends towards justice.
Well, it bends in a lot of different ways, and there's a lot of forces trying to bend it at any given time.
Yeah.
Sometimes it does, but that depends on us. You know, a lot of what I try and do with hope is say we don't know what's going to happen. We may have the capacity to influence, which is part of why some people like being hopeless. It lets them off the hook. If you're hopeful, you're on the hook to try, and that's, you know, and it's also the best way to live. So it's worth trying. You don't always win. You can't assume you're going to win. If you don't try, you're probably not going to. And if you do try, sometimes you do win. And the history of victories by mass movements, by progressives, by people who are supposed to be marginalized and powerless is really extraordinary and is all around us right now.
It's such a pleasure talking to you again. We talked last year at the end of the decade, and it's great to have you back on our radio. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. My pleasure.
That's Rebecca Solnit. She's the author of more than 20 books. Get a load of the titles, including A Field Guide to Getting Lost, A Paradise Built in Hell, and Men Explain Things to Me. I should have asked you earlier, are they still explaining things?
Every now and again, they sure are.
Her most recent book is a memoir. It's called Recollections of My Non-Existence. This morning, she was in the studios of KQED in San Francisco, California. I'm Michael Enright, and you're listening to the Sunday edition across Canada on CBC Radio 1 and across the United States on Sirius XM Radio Channel 169.